You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is the 16th and last lecture in this volume by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Universal Spirituality and Human Physicality, Bridging the Divide, Collected Works, Volume 202, translated by Matthew Barton. Lecture 16 was given in Dornach on the 26th of December, 1920. Let us cast our minds back for a moment over matters we have considered in recent days. On the one hand, I have highlighted the importance in accounts of the mystery of Golgotha of the shepherds, simple, deeply feeling people, and on the other of the Magi from the Orient, people who had attained the highest degree of wisdom possible in those times. The annunciation of the mystery proclaimed to the kings came from the stars, from a hearkening to world secrets, while the same annunciation was conveyed to the untutored, simple shepherds by virtue of a certain clairvoyance rooted in their reverence of heart, their genuine piety. Here, as I described, we discover the last vestiges of old powers of vision, which humanity in general once possessed as a normal faculty. When the mystery of Golgotha occurred, only the last remains of such powers existed in specially chosen people, either of the one highly educated and scholarly kind, or of the other untutored kind. In other words, the mystery of Golgotha occurred precisely at a time when only certain individuals retained the last vestiges of old powers of vision that were just adequate still to understand the supersensible nature of the Golgotha event. Now, let us once again characterize these two modes of knowledge in human beings. On the one hand, we have the shepherds, who in naive, inner, instinctive vision perceive what is happening in the world of humankind. Their inner visions, as I said, originate from the powers of the earth planet working into them. These earthly powers not only affect lower realms of nature, but also work through into the human being. Modern humanity, and people of today especially, no longer have any direct experience of these earthly powers, which in a sense rise up from the earth and appear in people's inner life in visions. But the further back we go in humanity's evolution, the more we find such inner visions occurring in people, and we also find these visions to be very different in nature, distinctively different depending on such things as diverse climatic conditions in different regions of the globe. Any external findings we can make in this area can, however, often be deceptive, and this is because people in those days were more likely to be nomadic. The inner capacities of perception they acquired through earth forces in a particular region migrated with them when they moved on to other territories and were passed down as inherited characteristics. And so we cannot always be sure that the kinds of inner vision that arose in people related directly to the territory where these visions actually appeared. Just as the fauna of a particular part of the globe have distinctive characteristics, expressed in animals in more outward forms and behaviors, so when human beings were in closer proximity to the powers of nature, they were inwardly configured in a way that connected them more with the earth's inner forces. These inner earth forces, however, are not wholly independent of the powers at work in the universe. Between birth and death, we are subject to these earth forces at certain levels of our configuration. The physical body and the etheric body, though not the astral body and I. Our physical body and ether body are certainly subject or surrendered to earth forces. In our physical body and ether body, we are subject to what is at work below in the earthly realm. And since humankind was far more dependent on the physical and etheric body in ancient times than it is today. The earth influences active in people also came to greater expression in their awareness, mediating a certain instinctive activity in their sensibility, a feeling perception of the human world itself, along with perception of the earth and also even of the animal world. In ancient times, people grew familiar with the world of animals by forming a particular image or imagination of each animal species. We have retained little of these imaginative pictures, and are today left only with abstract concepts of each species. We speak of the wolf, tiger, or cat species, and so forth. And these are the last abstract vestiges of what existed as living pictures in olden times, in instinctive vision. Likewise, in relation to other human beings in ancient times, people did not have the abstract feeling we nowadays have of our fellow human beings, whom we pass by like ships in the night, without really getting to know each other. The powers that lived in people then, as I have described, enabled them to form a certain picture, a vision, albeit one determined by their common destiny or karma, of their fellows as a very tangible, immediate imagination. In this primordial humanity, there also often lived something that concerned the whole earth, or for many peoples at least, the territories where they lived. This was an inner vision of the earth, including processes at work in the human world, as this came to expression in social existence, and also in relation to the life of animals. Our ordinary sensory perception developed from this kind of inner vision. We can put it like this: what filled people as their inner experience, as inner perception in pictures, later became sensory perception of external things in the modern era. Today this has become our mode of perception as, quote, worshipped, close quote, especially in scientific inquiry, in which only sense perceptions, combined by our reasoning faculty, are allowed any validity. This sensory perception with which we survey the tapestry of the sense world originated in what we discover, though not by means of the phantasms of modern psychology or anthropology, when we truly study the reality of old eras of humanity's evolution. The inner perception and vision of olden times has in the meanwhile become our external perception. The knowledge of the Magi from the Orient has transformed also and become abstraction, taking the opposite path. Inner vision came to attach to the surface of things to become sensory perception, while outward perception, expressed in imaginative, instinctive knowledge of the starry world and its secrets, as this appeared in ancient forms of astronomy, took the opposite path. This ancient astronomy, however, also made numerical calculations and described geometrical figures, or, to use a Platonic expression, it geometrized, see Plate 14. This old knowledge saw, as it were, a living mathematics inscribed in the cosmos, in which every star was at the same time a living spiritual intelligence. And this outer perception went inward into the human being and became abstract mathematics, abstract mechanics or astronomy. And all that rises from within us as mathematical and mechanical knowledge, as opposed to the inner vision that became sensory perception and what we call external empirical observation. Thus, in sensory observation on the one hand, and a mathematical and mechanical conception of the world, on the other, we have the abstract legacies of ancient instinctive perception. Even if external accounts of history and anthropology find no evidence of this, since the mystery of Golgotha, the last vestiges of ancient capacities of vision have faded, having in fact already disappeared much earlier than this in most of the earth's population. To really discover these ancient forms of human vision and knowledge, we would have to look back to very, very early millennia, prior to the origins of Egypto-Chaldean culture, Greek culture, and so forth, to the Turin Mountains of Persia. The last vestiges of such knowledge are apparent in Christian tradition in the visions of the shepherds, who became aware of an important event in mankind through their instinctive imaginative clairvoyance, and in the insights of the Magi from the Orient, who discerned the same thing by their star wisdom. The last vestiges of these primordial modes of perception are conveyed to us as a clear marker in human evolution. Since the mystery of Golgotha, the new mode of perception has spread increasingly. These developments were already emerging in Greek culture, for transitions are not so neatly demarcated. They gradually emerge and likewise fade slowly from view. In Greek culture, something was being prepared that only became clearly apparent in very recent times. Emerging especially since the middle of the 15th century and reaching its culmination in the 19th century, but already coming into view clearly in the 18th century, especially in Western Europe. This was the development of abstract mathematics and mechanics from an old spirit-permeated vision of the heavens, a way of surveying the heavens in accordance with the views of Galileo and Kepler, as if the realms of space can be understood merely in mathematical and mechanical terms, with perceptions confined to sensory information. Such a mode of inquiry is devoid of the powers of perception of the whole human being, as this existed instinctively in primordial times. We have often stated that humanity needs to return to a capacity for inner vision. What rises up within us as mathematics and mechanics must unfold again into imaginations. What can only be externally applied to the tapestry of the sensory world, all theoretical speculation, all kinds of mechanical theories about sensory processes involving wave oscillations and such like, must once again become subject to the visions of inspiration. By achieving this, humanity can again access its true sources, the spirit that is, after all, our truest, most intrinsic being. From olden times we have received mathematics as a last vestige of former capacities, and likewise have developed external sensory perception. And what has surfaced in humanity's evolution alongside this? Let us consider the 18th century for a moment, and the English philosopher Locke, who had such a strong influence on scientific development. Locke points us to knowledge mediated by the senses as really the only possible form of knowledge. In this view, sensory perception alone figured as something to which mathematics could be applied, since inner perception had become a merely abstract mathematical faculty. And the only remaining mode of perception was focused on external sensory reality. This was especially true in the West. The East continued to resist it. In France in the 18th century, there was an attempt to understand the human being and to answer the question about his real nature. Efforts were made to gain insight into human nature through the power of cognition available to people. This gave rise to a work such as De La Mettrie's, quote, "Man is a machine," close quote. This did not simply emerge as someone's bright idea, but arose from a world historical necessity of the times. It corresponded, in the modern era, to an encapsulation of human nature in ancient times based on all the knowledge ancient astronomy might have gathered about the phenomena of the heavens, producing a concept of the human being as originating from the whole macrocosm. A qualitative mathematics, which is nothing other than the old form of astronomy, or, let us say, astrology, would have underpinned this view of the human being. Albeit, without our conscious faculties, ancient peoples would still have comprehended the human being in very tangible ways, by means of their instinctive capacities of perception. What remains of this? By the 18th century, people conceived only of purely abstract mathematical lines in space, forces that can be grasped in abstract terms. They sought to understand the human being as a machine. This ingenious work I referred to, which basically conceived of human nature only in terms of mathematical and mechanical forces, continued to exert its spectral effect on into the 19th century and pervaded all scientific discourse, despite theoretical objections raised against it. People said this could not be true. Something else must also be at work in the human being. Yet despite theoretical or philosophical acknowledgement that, quote, man is a machine, close quote, could not hold true, the only powers applied to understanding the human being were basically the same as those used to understand a mechanism. Humanity simply had to pass through this evolution of the mind, of spirit, which, though it remains spirit, does so only in the most abstract sense, and in being only abstract, can only comprehend the mechanical and mineral realm. Only thereby could we come to awareness of freedom. The urge for freedom that came to such tumultuous expression in Western Europe in the 18th century, in the French Revolution, is, strange as it may seem, inwardly connected with that impoverished view of human nature revealed in Man is a Machine. On the one hand, we have the severest decadence in people's inner powers of perception, and on the other, a fierce insistence on human dignity and freedom. The other faculty, a vision cultivated within, was driven outward into the senses and diluted to become external sensory perception. This retained nothing of what leads people together in inner perception. Feeling alone came to govern social interactions. And in the 19th century, especially in Central Europe, and already in the 18th century in the West, individuals emerged who, in the distinctive way that all such things were grasped in Central Europe, recalled that during its evolution, humankind had perceived spirit by looking out into the macrocosm, had perceived gods, and, finally, God. Such individuals included Dupuy in the West and Ludwig Feuerbach and others in Central Europe. But at the same time, this gave rise to the strong instinct that the outer world, the tapestry of the sense world spread before me, is the only thing to be perceived. Old traditions, visions people had once had of verities contained in the shining stars, which are, after all, sensory perceptions initially, and of spiritual presences in minerals and plants, were all thought to have been the product of fantasy, an anthropomorphism or imaginative projection upon the surrounding world. In this view, gods had not created man, but the human psyche itself had created God. Dupuis, firstly, and then people such as Ludwig Feuerbach in the mid-19th century, proposed this idea. On the other hand, minds such as Darwin and those with similar views strongly asserted that sensory observation was the human being's only tool of perception. They proposed doctrines whose sole basis was to be this outward observation. But then it became apparent that the human being cannot be understood by these doctrines. A theory of evolution was constructed, a whole conceptual edifice from the simplest organisms right up to the most complex, with man standing at the pinnacle of the animal world. What understanding was there of the human being in this construct? Only what could be outwardly perceived through sensory observation. In 18th century France, people had elaborated the idea of man as a machine, and now in the 19th century, they regarded the human being only from without, and did not include inner human experience. They focused on the outer casing of the human being, his outward form, which is indeed the pinnacle of the animal kingdom. But what is enclosed within his skin does not stand at the pinnacle of the animal kingdom at all. It originates in quite different worlds, which were now closed to people, since they retained only sensory perception as a mode of inquiry, one which had developed from old faculties of clairvoyance. All that remained were mathematics and mechanics, which had developed from ancient astronomy, a living science of the spirit. Through an inner science, people could now only construct machines, and through an outer science, they were completely unable to, in quotes, construct the human being, seeing instead only his outward form and casing. The intrinsic nature of the human being gradually got lost. And today people really have no sense of the extent to which they have lost sight of a real knowledge of the human being. Animal anatomy, animal physiology, is practiced and then superimposed with some modifications on the human being. But today's science has no interest in developing true insight into the human being. As people look to what they regard as the highest authority today, to science, they can gain no awareness of human nature. Our current science emerged from a view of man as machine, from an understanding of the sensory world only, within which the human being as such cannot be found. In a recent publication attacking anthroposophy, in fact the one before last, yes, the pamphlets Anthroposophy is called on to refute are growing into whole tomes, we are informed that much in anthroposophy is reminiscent of ancient mythology. Anyone who says this fails to grasp anthroposophy. The author of this publication is a doctor of theology, a very scholarly gentleman. They're all scholarly gentlemen. That's a refrain that can always be uttered, echoing the famous speech in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar about all the honorable men. In this case, they're all scholarly gentlemen. In this particular one, since he does not understand anthroposophy, considers it to be a variation on old mythologies. In fact, we know that anthroposophy involves grasping the world in a fully conscious way, with just as much awareness as we otherwise bring to bear when grasping mathematical truths. And therefore, it really has nothing to do with traditional mythologies. Nevertheless, because our inner life is profoundly stirred, anthroposophy can sometimes make us aware of the meaning in ancient mythologies, ancient mythological views of the world. These ancient myths are by no means poetic invention in the form we know it today, but have emerged from an instinctive, imaginative capacity that does, however, accord with certain truths about the world. The content they convey is in pictorial form. And if we immerse ourselves in the deep significance of these pictures, we sometimes discover in them a very wonderful certainty of insight. Today I'd like to remind you of an ancient Indian poem addressed to the god Varuna, which I will reproduce in the following words. Quote, "Varuna is the energy active in all beings. Varuna is he who spreads air through the forests. Varuna is he who makes the swift animals fleet of foot. Varuna is he who calls forth milk in the milk-bearing cattle. Varuna is he who incites the will in human hearts. Varuna is he who strikes rays of lightning in the cloud waters. Varuna is he who lets the light of the sun shine forth in the dome of the heavens. Varuna is he who brings forth the soma drink upon the mountain slopes." In this invocation to Varuna, we find beautifully conveyed what I was speaking of yesterday. Let us first grasp what rises into a human being's physical and ether bodies from the earth's inner powers, so that the astral body and eye can surface in and alter his awareness. Here we can see how the earth's powers play into consciousness and bring about what became the powers of vision in ancient times, what generally enlivened both the human being's inner life and the earth itself. There is real significance in these words. We hear first how Varuna, the god of transformations, is the one who makes the wind, the air, wander through the forests, or in other words, the forest-clad earth. And then how this same being, in his dynamic energy, works from the earth through animals, causing horses to gallop swiftly, how he brings about life substance and milk-giving creatures, kindles will impulses in human hearts, which is precisely where an ancient inward clairvoyance arose. This invocation makes clear the mode of vision of the shepherds in the fields. And then, in what follows, we have something that makes comprehensible the particular mode of vision of the Magi from the Orient. For Varuna, you see, is the one who makes lightning flare in the cloud waters. Looking out into the macrocosm, one finds there powers that become known to the perception of the Magi. And these powers, those of Varuna, make the sun appear in the heavens and bring forth the soma drink on the mountains, which in turn works within human beings, enabling them to survey the whole world. But there is one thing to be noted here. This poem originated at a time when the most primordial vision of outward surroundings no longer existed in its purest form, and when purely spiritual modes of breathing, as common in ancient times, were no longer used to perceive the external world. Instead of imbibing with the in-breath what then gave rise to vision of the breaths of the cosmos, a certain drink, a herbal brew, was used a great deal in the later mysteries to initiate visions of the outer world. And in the same way, later, when inner vision had been lost, inner perception was stimulated by taking very specific substances. In the Orient, people used certain plant juices to stimulate their vision of the outer macrocosm. In Western lands, people began, likewise, to stimulate their perception through certain inner substances. In the Orient, the capacity whose last vestiges appeared in the Magi was invoked by external means, by imbibing something, the so-called soma drink. In the West, until the late medieval period, and even through into the modern era, the substance people sought to assimilate inwardly so as to invoke inner perception was called the Philosopher's Stone. In all the customary books concerning Orientalism, you can read about the soma drink or soma juice. These books contain many clever explanations of this tradition. And this is because true initiation wisdom about the actual substance of the soma drink has never been communicated. In many historical studies, too, you will read that no one is quite sure what the philosopher's stone consists of, what substance is referred to. I am not about to speak of these two substances either. I'd just like to highlight the rather humorous fact that while scholars will tell you there is no way of knowing what soma juice is made of, a great number of people drink liters of the stuff, an extract derived from a plant which, as the song of Varuna tells us, grows in mountainous regions. In the same way, people say they don't actually know what specific substance the alchemists were referring to in speaking of the philosopher's stone, and yet they are burning it in massive amounts nowadays. What matters is to see these things in the right light. It is strange that things frequently thought to be unknown and profoundly mysterious are actually very well known to us. This is because people do not grasp the relationship between their modern ways of thinking and those of a time not so very long ago. It would be important to realize that the spectacles we use to examine the world nowadays are very poor in quality. Despite our scientific education or training, we do not see what is right in front of our noses, do not recognize the actions of many substances that we use every day. These actions affect us and we experience them. Scholars do not know what the soma drink was, nor what the philosopher's stone referred to, despite the fact that one would be hard-pressed to find anyone who isn't very familiar with the substances in question. This is not much different to modern people having only a vague knowledge that something goes on between banks and big companies, and having very little idea what it means in the whole context of society when they cut out their share coupons, Our ways of looking and knowing blinker us so that we do not recognize what is really involved in our daily actions, or how we affect the inner context and reality of the world. It is odd the way people today try to keep their ideas floating upon the surface of things, and are so reluctant to plunge down into a new inner perception on the one hand, or rise up into a new knowledge of outward things on the other. Occasionally, something that most people do in fact want surfaces in them in obscure feelings, in dull awareness. But they take fright when this will starts to become conscious in them. A few days ago, one of our friends passed me a periodical about music and theater in the Rhine district. The first article there describes a musician's specific and direct experiences in a particular instance. It is extraordinarily interesting to read what someone records here of his specific experiences. I'll just read a few sentences from the article. For instance, quote, "Besides this inner problem of music, general convulsions in the social and economic domain have led to an external problem, that a new audience approaches art with relatively little preparation. What kinds of art have enduring worth, and how does one bring art and the people together? These two questions are of particular importance at present." Close quote. Most people, one has to say, are not even aware of the importance of these questions. This author is, at least. The questions he raises are highly topical and represent a dire burden in the world. He goes on, quote, "A great many problems could be better and more easily resolved if the music profession were properly organized. As yet, we still lack a chamber of musicians to represent the common interest of all professional musicians. The various interest groups within the profession have not even affiliated with each other." Close quote. The author now considers an appropriate form of organization and writes, quote, "Scarcely any of the associations comprise all members of the same class. The strongest, perhaps, are the German Musicians' Union, to which orchestral players mostly belong, and then the organizations trading in music supplies, whose economic goals naturally give them a common basis. A long way behind these, one then finds the diverse groups of academic and non-academic music teachers, singing teachers in schools, organists, conductors, and music critics, and also composers and soloists. Here, though, eccentricity and rivalry have kept many from joining. Members of all cultural professions are still a long way from recognizing the need for an umbrella organization. And this has led to a situation where jurisdiction in the musical domain, especially in relation to all public issues, has been handed not to professionals who know what is needed, but rather, both within government and in smaller provincial councils, to dilettantes. Depending on the strength of different parties, today politicians often just keep an eye, in quotes, on artistic matters alongside their chief duties. They may often be well motivated, yet they are unlikely to have the necessary knowledge and impartiality. This has meant that the state often fails almost entirely to cater for the genuine needs and justified requirements of music. But this phenomenon does not only affect music. It is typical of all domains of culture. Recently, a new finance committee was formed, in the knowledge that economic matters, too, cannot be properly dealt with by hitherto existing politically oriented national bodies. Of 400 seats on the committee, only 3 were allocated to arts governance. That's how important art was rated. And if you think that 1 or 2 votes are not enough to represent the interests of the German music profession in relation to financial concerns alone, then we surely have to ask where national cultural interests are going to be discussed and dealt with. We reject the parliamentary debates that have been held so far. As far as we know, there is not a single musician in Parliament, and even if there were 10 or 20 of them, they could achieve nothing in a context where party political viewpoints hold sway and are the deciding factor. There is therefore only one clear and logical way to proceed, which, when embarked on, will one day be to the whole nation's benefit. Alongside our political parliament, which administers the legal relationship between the individual and the rest of society, and between the whole nation and the international domain, and alongside the Finance Committee, which aims to manage society's material foundations, we also need a Culture Committee, whose task would be to care for cultural matters, to cultivate and further them. The idea of this threefold structure is not new, but has recently been summed up precisely and clearly by Dr. Rudolf Steiner, and is currently being publicized by the offices of the Association for the Threefold Social Organism in Stuttgart, which also provides further material on the subject for all who are interested. As one reflects further on these ideas, it becomes increasingly clear that they offer a sure solution to problems we have long been struggling hopelessly with. Their realization will and must heal our whole society. Close quote. I am reading this out to you because it shows how the desire for social threefolding arises in just a single profession. But those who have a merely superficial training in politics come along and tell us that this threefold idea is utopian. No, it is not utopian, but has been elaborated out of the inmost feeling of each and every profession or domain of society, and every single individual who works within a quite specific field, who exists in a specific and tangible context, like the author of this article. In fact, he is the journal's editor and manager, and it is very rare for the editor and publisher of a journal to write in this way, can sense that the most practical, pragmatic view of life will lead ultimately to the following conclusion. Quote, as one reflects further on these ideas, it becomes increasingly clear that they offer a sure solution to problems we have long been struggling hopelessly with. Their realization will and must heal our whole society. Close quote. The suggestion voiced in this article of the pressing need for a cultural committee to be formed was actually realized. In May of last year, a cultural committee was founded, and has already disappeared, has been forgotten. Its purpose was understood least of all by those invested with any office in academic or artistic life. It is vital to give urgent and serious attention to these things. People dislike too much seriousness. They prefer to hope that things will trot along nicely as they have in the past. But things will no longer trot along nicely. If people just carry on living in the same old way, without impulses from the world of spirit, industry and banks can continue to exist, all sorts of fields and disciplines can be taught at universities, other professions can go on being practiced, but everything will descend into decadence, barbarity, the collapse of civilization. Unless we seek to embed what can come from spiritual science in living realities, in society, then we are working for decline, not renewal. Today, most people are working for decline and just pretending to themselves that some kind of renewal will one day arise from this decline. It is this I wanted to especially highlight from various angles at this Christmas festival. Others may go on in their accustomed tracks, but they are pursuing and perpetrating a kind of universal lie. As a young man, I witnessed people living such lies. I had an extremely international outlook on life, on reality, on life's truths, and I was far removed from any sympathy or antipathy to any particular race. For a long time, many years, I worked as a tutor in a Jewish household. But every year, as Christmas approached, all the family's relatives, both near and far, all of whom were Jewish, set out to buy Christmas presents and a Christmas tree as well. All this was done in the same vein as all their neighbors, who called themselves Christian, along with the rest of the population. It was all done in honor of the phrase, quote, unto us the Savior is born, close quote. You see how empty these phrases have become. People just refuse to acknowledge the emptiness of these phrases, their lack of any real content. It has long been a matter of complete indifference whether people who place gifts beneath the tree have or don't have any living heart connection with the Savior. Such things demonstrate the lies of humanity that have become an enacted reality, the empty phrases that our civilization has made its reality. We have to look these things in the face with great seriousness. Today it is inappropriate to say that one should not be too radical if not being radical means furthering humanity's slide into decline and degeneration. At this Christmas festival, here in a place where there is really nothing at all left of the old style, I wanted to impress these things on you. There are really no traces at all of old styles of architecture here at the Gertianum, nor can you find signs here of old accustomed modes of life. And this is why many people hate the Gertianum, because it retains none of the old habits. Nor can we allow these habits to survive here, since today there must be one place in the world at least, even if this elicits such hatred that people seek to destroy it, which shows and illustrates what humanity now needs. The Gertianum contains nothing of the old. The science of Gertianism that we cultivate here contains scarcely anything of an old way of thinking. When we initiate anything in the practical domain, we can already see, in the response it elicits, that we're not working in old traditional ways. It may be another matter altogether whether all anthroposophists have overcome old-fashioned ways of thinking and living. Your lecturer today will politely pass over that subject. Nevertheless, he dares to express the hope that our habits, including our accustomed ways of treating children, will increasingly be in tune with our perception of the needs of developing humanity. The year that starts for us now with this Christmas festival will not be an easy one for the anthroposophic movement. What opposes us will not lose its momentum, but will, on the contrary, keep gaining in strength. You see, the powers interested in destroying anthroposophy are very awake and alert, as I have often said. There is one thing I'd like to remind you about in particular. When, in quotes, Futurum was about to be launched in Dornach, our dear friend Herr Molt stood here in this place and spoke of certain things that need to inform practical life. Every word he spoke was absolutely true. Afterward, I stood up and said I was not worried about all the resources needed to implement anthroposophic ideas and sentiments in outward practical work, in our institutions, to embody them in reality. The only thing I was anxious about, I said, was whether we could find enough people to demonstrate, we could find enough people able to demonstrate the capacity and industry to realize such a thing. It is vital that we always strive to bring together active, capable people in the world, people who can practically implement what anthroposophy can be. You see, recent centuries have conspired not only to dull human knowledge, but have also diminished people's really practical abilities. It is necessary for people to try to draw forth the necessary powers from the very depths of their being, which is where each and every person possesses such powers. We need renewal, also of humanity's capacities for practical action, and this must come from deep within us. As opposed to the sluggishness we find everywhere in the world, let us envisage the birth of active, stalwart powers that seek to emerge from within. Such a birth is one that can hover hopefully before us in all that we feel as the mood of Christmas. Consider the world of academia and of science. A young person, training to be a physician, came to see me a few days ago and spoke of the distress she was experiencing in her studies. I told her that the worst thing happening at present is that powers of thinking are not being developed at all, particularly in the most important sciences. Take any book about pathology or therapy, and very often you will find that the heart, lungs, digestive organs, and so forth are all set equally alongside each other in a merely superficial external manner, with the least possible engagement of thinking. And if you do try to bring some kind of thinking to bear on anything, then all that happens is what I found recently in the book by Kurt Lies, a doctor of theology. He stated there that Steiner's writings are irksome and irritating, since Steiner introduces ideas of the threefold nature of the human being, and one is meant to imagine that these three aspects do not stand side by side and separate, but are in fact in reciprocal interplay. the doctor of theology, considers such a thing to tax one's thinking excessively. Anyone who becomes a doctor of theology in the academic world today will first have his thinking drummed out of him, and then, when asked to think, he finds it irritating and extremely irksome. But this in turn leads to a shoddy state of affairs, when things that should emerge from deep within us, truthfulness, say, are given no place, even amongst leading representatives of Christianity. And then a priest, as I recounted, can state as fact that a statue of Christ has been made with luciferic features above and animal characteristics below, rather than telling the truth, that he was told this distorted rumor by someone else, a drunkard, perhaps. He sets forth something in a book, an objective lie, to characterize anthroposophy. And those who read it take it as at face value, unquestioningly, without objecting. Do you think that any social renewal or recovery can take place while such things are still possible? If you think this, I'm sorry to say you're harboring false hopes. We need to develop a healthy sense of what is morally worthless. We can leave the attack on anthroposophy to one side here. What matters is that a book is published containing not just one but a pack of lies. Anyone who writes such lies in one book will obviously write lies in every other book he publishes. It is a kind of bad habit, and this lives more or less in what people are taught today. We have to look carefully at these things. We must not simply ignore them. You see, ultimately the child who lay in the crib has this to say to us, if anything. A healing renewal of our deepest soul is needed. We must hearken to a new annunciation of what was proclaimed to the poor shepherds in the fields on the one hand, and to the wise magi from the Orient on the other. We must develop the ability to understand in its deepest foundations the nature of healing and redemption in human evolution. Only then are we worthy of saying, "Our Savior has been born." The end of Lecture 16, and that is the end of the book, Collected Work, Volume 202 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Universal Spirituality and Human Physicality, Bridging the Divide, The Search for the New Isis and the Divine Sophia.